The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
And so I think they've made some silly decisions where they said, well, if it's a motion to compel, it doesn't, maybe it's a, you know, it's not a very strong reason to make it public. But if it's a motion to dismiss, it's more. I mean, really, you have to look at the document. And here, you know, there is a statute, 18 U.S.C. 3500, that talks about Jenks material. You know, it says this is categorically sensitive and it's not discoverable. So, you know, if the government had never turned it over in the first place, we wouldn't be here. But they wanted to accelerate things, and there was a protective order in place, so they thought, look, we're going to try to let things go as fast as possible. Maybe we can get a trial quickly. And so they turned it over subject to this protective order. And now Trump has been trying to, you know, make public all of the witnesses' names, which is, you know, very dangerous.
I'm Quinta Jurassic, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, April 13th, 2024. It's another episode of Trump's Trials and Tribulations, recorded on April 11th in front of a live audience on YouTube in Riverside. I sat down with Anna Bauer and Roger Parloff to talk about the upcoming jury selection in the hush money case against Trump in New York City, and what Judge Cannon is up to in Florida, including her ruling on whether to unseal witness names. We also checked in on Fulton County to see what Fani Willis was up to and talked about Jack Smith's brief before the Supreme Court in the Trump presidential immunity case. And of course, we took audience questions from Lawfare Material supporters on Riverside. It's the Lawfare Podcast, April 13th, Trump's Trials and Tribulations. Jury selection starts Monday. So to start with, we're going to begin in the great state of New York, because despite a flurry of motions by Trump, which the New York appellate courts were not interested in, we are scheduled to begin his trial on Monday with jury selection. So Anna, what's happening? What should we know about the jury selection process that's happening next week? Anything that Trump has tried to knock this train off course?
Yeah, Quinta. So we do have jury selection starting on Monday, which is really kind of crazy to think about because it's been over a year now since this indictment was handed down. There's been a lot of twists and turns. And at one point we thought that we'd have another case that went first, but sure enough, this is going to be the first criminal prosecution of a former president in United States history. And it's happening on Monday. Lawfare's Tyler McBrien, who's our managing editor, will be there to cover for Lawfare. And then later on when the trial starts, I will be there as will Ben. Quinta and Roger may be making some appearances. So we are excited to cover the trial. But in terms of jury selection, what you need to know, we learned a lot more about how things are going to proceed on Monday, because Justice Mershon, who's the presiding judge in the case, sent out this letter to the parties, both the prosecution and the defense, in which he described, you know, how he plans to proceed. We have a podcast coming out on Monday that we just recorded today that goes into those procedures in a lot of detail. So I want to go through it, but maybe not in as much detail. But I suggest that people listen on Monday to the Lawfare podcast when that comes out, if you want a kind of more detailed understanding of the jury selection process. So basically what will happen, a group of jurors will show up in New York State Court on Monday. These are people who are just randomly, you know, selected from the voter rolls. They receive a notification in the mail, go to court. They will appear before Justice Mershon, who will then give them a number of preliminary instructions. So he'll read the case caption, the charges against the defendant. And then he will give them this, you know, kind of first glance at the case, which is this case summary. Interestingly, the case summary that he set out, specifically mentions that the prosecution, is kind of framing this as an election interference case, that these hush money payments, were done in order to, conceal, an agreement with others to unlawfully influence the 2016 presidential election. That's one of the, you know, lines in this case summary. So that's really interesting because it sets up and frames that this case is going to, be portrayed or likely will be portrayed as an election interference case, even though the charge itself is falsification of business records. So after providing that summary of the case, Justice Mershon will then go through some other preliminary instructions, some of the most important of which will be, you know, just setting out what it means to be an impartial juror, who is eligible to serve as a juror in New York State Court. And then he'll, you know, for example, list the names of people who might be witnesses or might be named in the case. The reason for that being that he needs to alert the jurors to that those identities so that, you know, if they have a personal or familial relationship with those people, which might disqualify them from serving as a juror on the case, then they can self-identify that they're ineligible to serve for that reason, that kind of thing. And then what usually happens is once he set out these instructions, the judge will ask the jurors to raise their hand if they are electing to self-identify as being ineligible to serve. And after people raise their hand saying, I'm not eligible to serve, usually they will then go up to the judge, you know, go up to the bench. The defense goes up and the prosecution goes up as well. And then they kind of have to explain like why it is that they're not eligible to serve. You know, maybe they don't feel they can be impartial. Maybe they are disqualified because they know one of the witnesses very well, that kind of thing. But in this particular case, it's a little bit different because Justice Mershon found that basically that usual process was going to be a little bit trickier because the courtroom is just like too small to like deal with all of the Secret Service and defense counsel and prosecution and everyone who's going to be packed in there covering the case. There would just be too many logistical issues with kind of doing this usual process, and it would be too drawn out and inefficient. So what he decided to do instead is that instead of having this individual interview with the jurors, he will just dismiss outright anyone who elects to say, hey, I'm not eligible to serve. And so anyone who raises their hand will then be dismissed. And then we proceed to the voir dire process. That's the process by which the jurors answer questions. And then they are questioned by both the prosecution and the defense, who get the opportunity, get a certain amount of time to question jurors. They kind of go out in groups and read out the answers that they gave to this jury questionnaire. We got a look at that questionnaire. It is 42 questions. And we can talk a little bit about the substance of that if you want, but it basically asks things like, you know, what kind of media do you consume? Or, you know, have you ever been a Proud Boy? So things that are kind of proxies.
Are you a member of Antifa? Which I guarantee yeah. you, nobody who would identify themselves as Antifa would identify themselves as a member of Antifa on a court document.
Exactly. But so questions like that that serve as a proxy for some type of information that the defense or the prosecution wants to know and can give them kind of an idea of who the juror is. And then, you know, after that initial period when everyone's writing notes about what the answers to this questionnaire, how they answered the questionnaire questions, then each side kind of has an opportunity to question the jurors, ask them, you know, certain types of questions, although it's really up to Justice Mershon if they can. There are some questions that maybe he will say, you know, you can't ask that. I think one of them, Roger, correct me if I'm wrong, was just like, they wanted to ask, do you like Donald Trump? And Justice Mershon said, no, I don't want you to ask that question. So that's kind of how that goes. And then there will be a process, you know, for exercising certain types of challenges in which they, both the prosecution and the defense, are trying to get rid of jurors that they maybe don't want on the jury. And there are two different types of challenges. There's for cause challenges. Those are unlimited, and they relate to either a juror's inability to be impartial, or they relate to a juror's ineligibility to serve. So things like under New York state law, maybe you live outside of Manhattan. That means that you can't then sit as a juror in a Manhattan criminal case. So you can have these for cause challenges, but then you have peremptory challenges as well. And that's more of like things that, you know, basically anything that the prosecution or defense wants, as long as it's not within a certain number of categories, like race, for example. And if either side believes that a peremptory challenge has been, used in a way that was improper, for example, based on race, then, you know, they can challenge that peremptory challenge itself or raise an objection to it. So there's kind of this process of back and forth there with all of that. And then this goes on in several rounds, with several rounds of different groups of jurors until we finally end up with a group of 12 jurors and six, I think it'll be six alternates, but maybe he'll do more. But that's usually, you know, 12 jurors, six alternates, in a case like this. So that is the process that you can expect. Did I miss anything, Roger?
No, that sounds good. I don't think I have anything to add. I just mentioned that Justice Mershon did handle the People versus Trump Organization case maybe a year ago. And so he knows the ropes here a little, and he went through a jury selection process in a very similar case, and that's part of what's informing his ideas about how to streamline this, because he found some things that got bogged down and achieved little last time around. And I think the lawyers didn't resist much. I think they agreed.
And do we have any sense of how long the jury selection process might take?
I think it's estimated to be, I want to say that jury selection, I went to a hearing back in March in Mar-a-Lago before Judge Cannon. She asked about the timing of jury selection plus the trial. I think that they said like 2 to 3 weeks jury selection could last. I think that's about right. I don't expect it to really go over 2 to 3 weeks. It could, especially because Justice Mershon has decided to dismiss jurors who self-identify as being ineligible to serve outright and not have that, you know, interview process. I think that'll save a lot of time. So, you know, it could go even quicker. Like we could see opening statements, you know, April 22nd, that next Monday. So we'll see. But I don't expect it to go over 2 to 3 weeks.
You know, I watched the jury selection in the Proud Boys case in D.C., which there was a lot of problem getting jurors that, you know, felt they could be fair there. But it still went about 2 weeks, is how I remember. And now the federal system is a little more, only the judge asks questions there. But at the same time, there were also five defendants there, which made it complicated as well. So I think 2 weeks is sort of a reasonable guess.
I mean, so would it be fair to say in that case that, you know, if you've seen the headlines that say Trump trial starts Monday and you're expecting there to be a big bang and lots of excitement, that you are in for some disappointment, because what we're probably going to have is 2 weeks of arguing over, you know, whether the fact that someone moved to New York from Florida shows that they're biased?
I mean, I think for the layperson, it is very true that jury selection would be...
And Anna wants to defend jury selection.
I love jury selection because it is like the most important part of a case, and it can make or break a case. And it's really interesting to see how people respond to these questions, to see the strat. It's a game of strategy. It's really fascinating to me, but I do think everyone else would probably be really bored. So we'll see. But yeah, Roger, what about you? What do you think?
I think most people would not consider it the most exciting part of the case, but you're right. It's crucial. It's absolutely crucial. So, and you know, sometimes it's inspiring, if you believe in the jury system. So I do expect that at the end of it, we will hear more motions to move the case out of Manhattan. We've seen they can't be fair. It's too many that, so there will be last ditch motions like that, but I don't think they'll be successful.
Yeah. And one other thing to mention that we haven't is that this will be an anonymous jury, except not anonymous to the parties and their counsel. But these instructions that Justice Merchan will give are very careful to ensure that, you know, the jurors are not revealing their addresses and names when they're doing voir dire. The court has also said, you know, no sketches of juror. There's no cameras in the courtroom, of course, but, you know, there's a prohibition on sketches in the courtroom as well. So people will know some things about the jury that's ultimately selected based on their answers to the questions in court. There are other things that we won't know. And it won't be kind of as prone to, you know, internet sleuths going and snooping on jurors' social media and all that. Although certainly defense counsel will be doing that. So yeah, it'll be a very interesting, or interesting to me and to Roger and to Tyler, who's covering it. I think I'm excited for it.
And remember that political registration, political contributions, that's all open source information. So the parties will have access to that, even though we don't.
All right. Anything else we want to touch on in New York before we move south?
Oh, there's a slew of last ditch mandamus petitions this week. Three so-called Article 78 petitions. The Trump has been. They've mainly been trying to get adjournments while other issues are litigated. So far, all of those have been denied by a single justice of the Appellate Division First Department. And all of those will be heard by a full panel of five justices, just the stay part of it. And that'll probably happen Monday, but we're not really expecting any of those to actually delay the start.
All right, let's take a hop, skip, and a jump down to Florida, where Roger, Judge Cannon has been, I don't know if busy is the right word, but she's done some things.
She has. I might say busy. The one thing that I consider big is, you know, she had this question. She had issued an order on February 6th where she was going to unseal the names of almost two dozen witnesses or FBI agents, as well as their testimony or their statements to the FBI, what we usually call Jenks material, which isn't usually turned over until the witness testifies after the, or, you know, a few hours before. And she was going to make all of this public. The government was, and she made an order to this effect. It didn't go into effect. The government moved to reconsider, made it clear that if she persisted, they would take her to the 11th Circuit on this. And she sort of backed down. She mainly backed down. It was a 24-page order. It was extremely defensive. You know, in order to do a motion to reconsider. You have to, you know, the only way you're entitled to it is you have to argue that as things stand, it's clearly erroneous and a manifest injustice. She took that very personally, like, and so she tried to show, well, it might be erroneous, but it's not clearly erroneous. And then she said, you know, I don't have to do this, but I'm going to do it. So she backed down, but, and in fairness to her, the special counsel didn't handle this correctly. I think they assumed that she would understand the sensitivity and agree with, you know, she was in the Southern District of Florida U.S. Attorney's Office for 7 years. You would think she might. She certainly didn't. And then the Press Coalition filed a brief and, of course, takes the position the Press Coalition always does, you know, make everything public. Because they expect, you know, that's their job, and they expect the government to push back. The government didn't push back. They said, and it was very strange. They said, well, we disagree that the Press Coalition has a right to intervene. We don't think they have a right to intervene. They explained why. We said, now, if you want to submit an amicus brief, we leave that to you. And they didn't engage with any of the arguments. Which was, and so she adopted wholeheartedly all of those arguments.
And so can I ask, is your read here just that she genuinely didn't understand that what the government was kind of assuming that she would understand about the sensitivity of that material?
It seems, you know, she goes into these things believing that everything Trump argues is probably right. And, you know, there is that. and, you know, it's unmistakable. And she's been angry with the special counsel from day one. So I don't know, you know, but she does seem to, I think she has a sort of a, she can't see the forest for the trees thing. She gets caught up in the rules and she doesn't look at, in this case, you know, there are a lot of different, the courts have struggled with this question, well, which sorts of discovery documents can be, should be made public and not. And so I think they've made some silly decisions where they said, well, if it's a motion to compel, it doesn't, maybe it's a, you know, it's not a very strong reason to make it public, but if it's a motion to dismiss, it's more, I mean, really, you have to look at the document. And here, you know, there is a statute, 18 U.S.C. 3500, that talks about Jenks material. You know, it says this is categorically sensitive and it's not discoverable. So, you know, if the government had never turned it over in the first place, we wouldn't be here. But they wanted to accelerate things, and there was a protective order in place, so they thought, look, we're going to try to let things go as fast as possible. Maybe we can get a trial quickly. And so they turned it over subject to this protective order. And now Trump has been trying to, you know, make public all of the witnesses' names, which is, you know, very dangerous. And so she went along. So I just can't tell exactly what's going through her mind. But anyway, she backed down as far as witness identities, but not the statements themselves. And so she says, if you redact the identities, the biographical information that might identify them in the statement, then you can use the statement. So it's going to be up to Jack Smith whether that's worth trying to mandamus. I think the answer is probably no, but it's an ongoing question. Like, we're having a hearing on Friday on three motions involving in the Mar-a-Lago case involving Nauta and de Oliveira only. And there is some stuff, especially in the Nauta, one of the Nauta motions, that is currently sealed. and she wants to make most of it public. Again, she'll protect the identities nominally. So it's up to Jack Smith, whether can you really protect identities that way? And also there are other reasons this stuff is kept secret. Witness statements, you know, in a criminal case, it sometimes happens that the accused criminal is a criminal. And sometimes, you know, if you tell criminals what the evidence is, they'll manufacture evidence or, you know, they'll tailor testimony to try to circumvent what the government has against them. And so you don't turn it over now. You can also, if it makes a splash, the jurors will find out about it. So there's a lot of other reasons that this is normally kept secret. So it's going to be up to Jack Smith to decide, can he live with this sort of ruling, which is not going away. It's a continuing issue. And then, as I mentioned, there is this hearing Friday, the three. I can't tell you a lot about it because all three motions are still undocketed. It's another issue. But two of them are motions for a bill of particulars by Nauta and De Oliveira. Those are pretty technical. There's a motion to dismiss by Nauta that is apparently about alleges vagueness and has he's claiming that the obstruction of justice charges in particular are vague in some way and that might be affected by there's a ruling coming up. Well, there's a Supreme Court argument next week called United States versus Fisher, we'll come back to, which doesn't really involve these charges. But anyway, a couple of things that strike me, though, is that often, like Judge Chutkan does not hold hearings very often because it's time consuming and it doesn't usually, you know, you read the briefs, you get the picture, you rule. Sometimes it'll help. With the gag order, she did hold a hearing because it was very important, First Amendment issues and so on. This is the, you know, a bill of particulars. These are things that are not, you know, many judges would not have ordered hearings. And it makes you wonder, you know, there were 14 motions. There's now 12 still left to be decided. One motion to compel and 11 motions to dismiss or bill of particulars or motion to suppress. And does she plan to hold hearings on all of them? And the defendants want hearings, obviously, on all of them. And they've asked for evidentiary hearings on at least 10 of them. So far, thank goodness, she hadn't ordered that. So that's a concern.
Yeah, and Roger, just real quick on that point, I mean, it's worth noting that, for example, the government's proposed schedule did build in, you know, I mean, I think at first they just said like one day for motions hearings or something, but then they ultimately kind of said, okay, well, a lot like 3 days in a row, they wanted like a marathon because it's just more efficient that way. You know, these parties are coming in from out of state. It's really hard to get to Fort Pierce. It makes sense as just an efficient judicial efficiency and, you know, resources and time perspective to go ahead and set all these motions for hearing, if she's going to hear them all, have them come down for like a day or two, get it over with. But instead, she's doing this really kind of like scattered process where you'll get a few motions that, you know, she'll, and then motions that don't need all day hearing, she will hear them, you know, for hours. So it's just a really underscores some of the just more strange ways that she is handling things.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. She's not going in the order. The first two she heard were the first two that the defense team wanted. Then they wanted, I mean, their highest priority is something called a motion to compel, which would get them a ton more discovery. That would take a long time in itself, and they could, you know, there would be still more documents to attach to motions and have fights over. And she hasn't done that one yet. And of course, now I think these three just in, since these three just involve not Trump, she originally set the meeting, the hearing for April 19th. And so the Trump trial in New York would be underway. So I think she thought, okay, so I'll just do these three that aren't Trump. But, we're getting bogged down at this point. Also this week, yesterday, she did something interesting. She ordered that, expert disclosures and the SEPA Section 5 notice should be filed on May 9th. Now, so that is 7 weeks later than the government had hoped.
And the original date was November, right?
Yeah, no.
So we're only running a few months behind schedule.
Yeah, I mean, both right before, remember there was an all-day hearing March 1st about when the new trial date should be. And then, and so for that, both sides put a new schedule in. And so these dates would be 7 weeks later than the government want. They would be, however, 5 and 8 weeks earlier, respectively, than Trump wanted. But the Section 5 notice, that's a thing where the defense notifies the government and the court of which classified documents it is going to want to use. That'll be, you know, that won't be a public, it's going to want to present. And the thing is, as Brian Greer noted, he goes on Twitter as Secrets and Law. He's a former CIA general counsel or attorney. And he noted that you can't really do the Section 5 notice until the motion to compel is decided. So, you know, that could mean she plans not to grant the motion to compel, or it could mean she didn't think about that. We'll have to see how realistic that is.
I seem to recall, I need to look back at my notes, but there was at the March 1st hearing, there was a time when it was raised this question of maybe multiple rounds of certain types of SEPA litigation, which is not usually what happens, but it seemed that at the March 1st hearing, she was contemplating that.
Certainly Trump talked about that. Yeah. And when she decided most of the SEPA Section 4 stuff, she did indicate there would have to be a follow-up SEPA Section 4 thing. One little thing, she, you know, the government every month files under the local rules something called a speedy trial report. And the last 8 of them, there's been no dispute. The defense concurs in everyone. But she asked on April 2nd, she asked that the defense team specifically file their own speedy trial report and discuss whether they're asserting or waiving their speedy trial rights, and if so, within what time frames. So it sounded to me like she's going to formally reset the trial date pretty soon, and she wants to get her ducks in a row as far as the speedy trial situation. The Speedy Trial Act is a pretty weak statute. It gives... You're supposed to hold the trial within 70 days of the first appearance, but with a slew of exceptions. And we have not used one day of the 70-day clock. It's been told, meaning stopped, for various reasons. And it stopped until May 20th. And then it starts counting again. And so I think she's anticipating. And in response to that, the defense did provide a great deal of advice about how she could delay forever without using up a time. And one of the ways was, you know, each time you file a motion, that tolls the clock until, I forget the magic language, until after the hearing, and then a certain amount of reasonable time to decide it, maybe 30 days, and it could be maybe 30 days after post-hearing briefs. So you might think there are a lot of ways to make this go on forever.
So where do we stand on this week's evaluation of the question of what exactly Judge Cannon is doing well, and what is motivating all this.
Well, she certainly, so far, she's successfully avoiding 11th Circuit review. And I don't think this documents thing is where Jack Smith wants to plant his flag, but I might be wrong. It depends how, you know, only he knows how damaging having all of these documents be partially exposed in this way is. He, like I say, it's not the perfect record for him because he sort of screwed up in not procedurally earlier, but still, it is something he could do. The scariest thing is clearly that jury instruction tumult we had last week that we talked about. And I think she covered herself. It would be very, very hard for him to go to the 11th Circuit because basically she said, look, I'm just acting in good faith. I'll make my decision the way every judge does during the trial. We'll have a jury conference, and then that's when it's usually done. So you would really have to, you know, have the 11th Circuit say she's not being candid with us, and there's no basis, I mean, for doing that. So I don't know. It's not a very optimistic situation.
Finding your perfect home was hard. But thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Could your political views make you the target of cybercrime, identity theft, stalking, or even violence? I used to think this was silly, and then weird things started happening to me. Someone defaced my car. It had Lawfare license plates on it. Somebody delivered weird antique postcards of Guantanamo Bay to my house. You know, weird stuff. The volume of personal data online has tripled between 2019 and 2023. And angry individuals fueled by political polarization can access it all for up to 98% of American citizens. And I was one of them. Lots of people were using my name, my home address, other information about me to try to intimidate me. And I want to say that has dramatically slowed down in recent months. And one of the reasons is Delete Me. As I have said before, there are products here that I read the ads because, you know, that's my job. And there are products here that I read the ads because I really use them and really like them. And Delete Me is one of the Lawfare advertisers that I am most enthusiastic about. And here's why. It finds and removes personal information I don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from all of the largest search databases on the web. And in the process, it helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. And here's the important point. It doesn't just do it once, because the information will get back into the systems. It does it, and then it does it again. So the first time I got one of these reports, and they send regular reports at Delete Me, you know, there were a whole bunch of systems that I'd come off of. But then each time I get one now, there's still one or two or three that I'm back on the system and Delete Me has once again deleted me. So sign up and provide Delete Me with exactly what information you want deleted, and their experts will take it from there. And as I say, they send regular personalized privacy reports showing what info they have found, where they found it, and what they removed. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. When you sign up, they immediately go to work scrubbing all your personal information from data broker platforms. Your personal profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me now at a special discount for Lawfare listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use the promo code Lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code Lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code Lawfare20.
Well, maybe Boy Wonder Judge McAfee can cheer us up. Anna, what's been going on in Georgia?
So Boy Wonder continues to Boy Wonder, or I mean, I not really. I mean, he's fine, but he's it's not like he's done anything, you know, super impressive. But he did hand down an order today, this week. And so he continues to show that he's working on these substantive motions. Even though Trump is still trying to appeal that disqualification order, and we're waiting for the Court of Appeals in Georgia to decide on that. Judge McAfee again said, you know, the case isn't paused. I'm going to continue to crank out these orders. And he did just that this week. He issued an order denying Kathy Latham's motion to strike Act 160 from the indictment. That description deserves a little bit of explaining. If people remember how this RICO indictment is kind of set up, is that you have all these different series of acts within the indictment. And there are certain overt acts that the state has to prove that, you know, either the defendant or their co-conspirators did in terms of, you know, proving up this racketeering, charge, which is the top charge in the indictment. And Act 160 accuses Kathy Latham, who is the former Coffee County Republican chairwoman, who is alleged to be involved in the Coffee County voting system breach. She is alleged in Act 160 to have committed perjury during a federal court proceeding in a civil suit called Curling versus Raffensperger. That suit is the one that, you know, led to the discovery of the Coffee County voting system breach. Latham sat for a deposition in that case, and Fulton County prosecutors now claim that she perjured herself during that suit. But Latham is not actually accused of the substantive crime of perjury, which is a little bit confusing. But in a RICO prosecution, you don't even have to charge someone with a separate crime. You know, you can just say that they committed a certain, you know, she committed perjury in federal court, but they don't even have to charge her with perjury, as a substantive offense. They just have to be able to say that as an overt act, furthering the conspiracy to overturn the election, she committed perjury. The reason being, you know, that they allege she was trying to basically cover up, the Coffee County voting system breach. So she filed this motion in which she said that because this conduct is alleged to have occurred in federal court, only federal law could apply, and that therefore, you know, that act needs to be struck from the indictment. Judge McAfee said no. He said, you know, you cite one case, and even like taking this case even if it was correct, it still wouldn't apply because here Kathy Latham has not been charged substantively with perjury. This is just an overt act that is alleged to be part of the racketeering scheme to overturn the election. And so therefore, you know, it's inapplicable. And it's basically, it's Act 160 is staying in the RICO indictment. So Kathy Latham can still appeal. She has, like everyone else who tries to seek an appeal pretrial in Fulton County, she has to get Judge McAfee to issue a certificate of immediate appeal within, a certificate of immediate review within 10 days of when the order was issued. That is affects basically a permission for her to then go to the Court of Appeals and try to get an interlocutory appeal from them. So that's kind of where we are with that. And then at the same time, we had Fannie Willis's response to Trump's appeal of the disqualification order in which Judge McAfee declined to disqualify Fannie Willis on the basis of her relationship with Nathan Wade and then extrajudicial statements that she made outside of court. And the response, there's not really much new in it, you know, other than the state says that defense counsel didn't meet their burden for seeking an interlocutory appeal. The court should decline to hear the appeal prior to trial. And, you know, basically the trial judge got it right. But something that did stick out to me is that in this brief, you know, usually in a brief, you have several different points and you try to put the ones that you're like most worried about or that you think is your strongest argument, like up at the top. And I mean, it's not always how it works, but it's kind of a good rule of thumb. And in this brief, they really focused a lot at the top part of the brief on the forensic misconduct allegations. So those are the allegations that, you know, Fannie Willis went to this church and made these out-of-court statements that prejudiced the defendants. That's what they call forensic misconduct in Georgia. That can be a way to disqualify a district attorney. And you know, of course, they're arguing that she didn't commit forensic misconduct. And certainly Judge McAfee did find that she didn't rise to the level of forensic misconduct, but he did say things that were like, you know, there's not a lot of case law on this and it was legally improper for her to say these things. So I think that it really indicates that, you know, that this is something that the district attorney's office is maybe most worried about in terms of whether the Georgia Court of Appeals will take up the case, because they really deprioritize these other issues of, you know, the findings on the relationship with Nathan Wade. But that, oh, and there's one more thing that happened in Fulton County, Quinta. Do you want to hear it?
I do.
Okay. So people might recall that summer of 2022 now. I wanted to say last summer.
Cast your mind back.
If you
can.
To the
summer of 2022.
So much has happened since then. But when Fannie Willis first really got going with this investigation, she was investigating the fake electors. She was investigating a lot of, you know, politicians in Georgia, some of whom ended up being indicted. But one of those people was Georgia's current lieutenant governor, Burt Jones. And Fannie Willis was disqualified from investigating him in the summer of 2022. The reason being that she held a fundraiser for Charlie Bailey, who at the time was Burt Jones' political opponent in the lieutenant governor's race in Georgia. So she was subsequently disqualified. And the way that it works, of course, if a district attorney is disqualified, then the case is referred to a nonpartisan state agency called the Prosecuting Attorneys Council. There's a guy in charge of that, of the PAC, as we call it. His name is Pete Scandalakis. And he looked for many months to find someone who might take the case. You know, there was a good amount of criticism of PAC for, you know, taking over a year and a half to appoint someone to investigate Burt Jones. And today we learned that Pete Skandalakis has appointed himself to, to investigate Burt Jones.
He was the most qualified man for the job. Well, there was simply nobody else.
So again, I want to stress that I think one of the, you know, they did have a number of candidates they were thinking to appoint, but it's a really low pay. It's, you know, a politically sensitive investigation, that kind of thing. So we do have someone who is going to investigate Burt Jones. The statute of limitations, I believe, is coming up. So, you know, I think that it's 4 years for felony charges. And I think that'll be January 2024.
Oh, wow. So the clock is really ticking.
So, yeah.
And it wasn't, there's no tolling that
happens?
Well,
that's what I don't know. I haven't looked into it far enough to know whether there's issues with tolling and, you know, that kind of thing. But yeah, so the statute of limitations, that clock is ticking. We also don't know exactly what the scope of this investigation will be. You know, initially, Burt Jones, he was a fake elector. He was a state senator at the time. He is someone who was involved in that. But also, I attended the case I mentioned that uncovered the Coffee County breach, Curling versus Raffensperger, that civil suit. They had a trial in January, which I attended. And during that trial, there was evidence presented in which, and I have the, you know, I pulled up the exhibit just to read it. This is an email that was presented at trial from Michael Barnes, who worked in the Georgia Secretary of State's office. And this was December 22nd. And he wrote to a number of people in the Georgia Secretary of State's office saying, Butts County just called me. Butts County is where Burt Jones is from. Butts County just called me. Tina, the elections supervisor or someone involved in elections there, is saying that Senator Burt Jones has talked to her election board chairman and wants to bring a forensic analyst to inspect their election management computer. I told Tina to immediately contact Chris to make him aware of this effort. And then Ryan Germany responded that this would be against the law. They are not allowed to give an unauthorized person access to their EMS server. That would be a huge security breach. So there were some people who were suggesting that maybe this aspect of Burt Jones' conduct also maybe should be investigated. I do not know if that is something that Pete Skandalakis has plans to look into, but just did want to note it because that was a kind of more recent development earlier this year where that came to light. So that's all that's happening in Fulton County, Quinta.
All right. Well, let's move it on up to Washington, D.C. And this is actually, I'm going to pass the baton to you, Anna, for the hosting job here, because we're going to be talking about the briefing in the Trump immunity case before the Supreme Court, which I have read and I have thoughts on.
Right. So for the D.C. case, which we do not get a lot of D.C. case action these days, but we did get some this week because Jack Smith filed their brief before the Supreme Court on the presidential immunity appeal. Arguments are set to happen April 25th in that case. And so, Quinta, why don't you tell us about it? What did Smith argue? And, you know, what's the, give us the kind of what we need to know.
I think that this is pretty consistent with Smith's past filings in this. It's essentially saying, you know, there is no absolute immunity here for former presidents for conduct that occurred during their presidency. And anyway, even if there is, it's narrower than what Trump is asking for here. I think in my view, what's particularly interesting here is kind of a back and forth that is happening between Trump and Smith over something that's called the clear statement rule, which is very complicated and which I will give a very, very high altitude overview of here. Essentially, The argument, this is something that comes out of the Office of Legal Counsel, so sort of the in-house think tank for the Justice Department, is that if a criminal statute does not explicitly identify the president, then it doesn't apply to him. That is massively oversimplified, but I think it'll do for the purposes of this conversation. And Trump raised that in his Supreme Court brief, though he didn't address it in the briefing below, to say, well, look at this. How can these criminal statutes possibly apply to me, given that I was the president at the time? And so Smith is kind of pushing back on that here and essentially says, you know, look, if you look at the same OLC memos that Trump is drawing on in making this argument, they actually don't say, you know, a criminal statute has to explicitly say, yes, we mean the president too, in order for it to apply to the president. For example, there's an OLC memo that says, you know, the bribery statutes apply to the president, even though they don't say, also, you can't do a bribe if you're the president, right? Because the president has no constitutional authority to take a bribe. And we know that because he can be impeached for it. So bribery is unusually clear-cut in that sense. But Smith is essentially saying here, you know, we can extend that principle more broadly to say that we don't need to worry about the clear statement rule in instances in which the president doesn't have any constitutional authority to begin with, because we wouldn't need to be worried about Congress, and in this case, the courts, infringing on that power, because it doesn't exist to begin with. There's also a hefty portion of the brief that is sort of calling Trump out on some of the misrepresentations, I think it's fair to say, that he made in his brief before the Supreme Court, sort of fudging his citations, suggesting that a number of OLC memos, court cases, law review articles by, among other people, Brett Kavanaugh, had to do with immunity protections for a former president, as well as a sitting president, and essentially saying he's extending this in ways that just simply don't make sense, given that he is no longer in office. So I will say that was a bit cathartic for me, because I had been tearing my hair out a little bit reading Trump's brief and seeing exactly how he had kind of misframed and misstated things in a lot of ways. And I think that the other thing that I want to note before I hand it over to you, Roger, to talk about what this says about the Fisher case, is Smith's suggestion for how the court should sort of handle this procedurally. And essentially what he says here is, okay, so, you know, if the Supreme Court says no immunity under any circumstances, that makes it easy. We can just kick it back to the district court and move forward. If the court instead says, well, yes, there is some immunity, but does it apply here? We don't know. You can imagine a world in which that leads to a lot more litigation over the course, you know, then it stretches things out even more as Smith and Trump go back and forth over these issues. And so what Smith proposes essentially is that the district court should be able to handle this over the course of the trial, and that the Supreme Court should, in that case, remand it to the district court, and that the district court will then be able to address this, and I'm quoting here, through evidentiary and instructional rulings at trial, essentially saying, let's just kind of fold it all together. And this is essentially a way of saying, you know, we really want to get this moving forward. Like, can we please, please, please get to trial here?
So are you saying the fear animated, like what's animating this is the fear that the Supreme Court will say, yeah, there's some level of immunity for, you know, former presidents when it comes to criminal prosecutions, but we need to send this back for an evidentiary hearing maybe to figure out, you know, what is official or what is that the concern? And then that would then risk, you know, the case going back up in terms of distinguishing what's official and not official. Or is there something at like what is the
that's,
kind of
that's how I read it. Okay. Certainly, Roger, I don't know if you have thoughts.
I think that's exactly how I read it too, because that's one of the biggest things people fear, is that they would send this back for more findings and that those could be appealed, and then you would never, you know, this wouldn't be decided. There's no way. So he's asking the court to be clear that if there are findings to be made, they can be made by the district judge at trial as evidentiary rulings and in the jury instructions, and then you can appeal those after.
And what did you guys make? I mean, what did you make of that argument? Convincing?
I thought it made sense. I mean, it's kind of hard to say without getting a sense of what the court is thinking, right? I mean, I think Smith would much prefer it if the justices just say, nope, no absolute immunity.
Yeah.
You know, goodbye, go back to the district court. So this is kind of trying to help him out a little bit as kind of a backstop.
I think it really sort of gets into how much you believe that the Supreme Court is, that this is all an exercise in legal theory, or whether some subconsciences are at work here. And some people in their subconscious do not want this case to take place before the election. And, you know, if that's what's going on at some level of consciousness, they're going to require findings and so on. So I don't know that a paragraph like this can persuade a subconscious that is hell-bent on another result. But if this is all, you know, totally on the level, you know, just it sounds convincing to me, but.
Okay, well, Roger, let me ask you about a footnote in the brief that stood out to us because it involves a case that we've talked about on the live stream before. It's called Fisher, and it's in footnote 10 that this case is brought up. So why don't you remind everyone why this case is important and what does the special counsel say about it?
Yeah. Fisher versus United States is going to be argued next week on Tuesday, the 16th, in front of the Supreme Court. And this is about a very important statute for the January 6th cases. It's called 18 U.S.C. 1512 C2. And it also is the basis for two of the counts against Trump in the D.C. case. This is corrupt obstruction of an official proceeding. Well, at least as of April 5th, there were 353 defendants charged with this in January 6th. That's almost a quarter of all of the defendants, around a quarter. And it's a two-part statute that was added in as part of the Sarbanes-Oxley law after Enron. It's there's 1512 C1 and 1512 C2. 1512 C1 is narrow. It's about altering, destroying, mutilating, concealing documents with intent to impair the object's integrity or availability for use in an official proceeding. And the second provision is a catch-all, broad and catch-all, and says, or otherwise obstructs, influences, or impedes any official proceeding. So the government has always said that, you know, it means what it says, corruptly obstructing, impeding an official proceeding. Very broad, and it covers doing that through a riot. There's another provision, 1515 A1 something, that it says that a proceeding can be a congressional proceeding as well as other kinds of proceedings. So that's, you know, the government's theory is that this is the natural reading, but and 14, at least 14 district judges read it that way in D.C., but one didn't. And so Carl Nichols, and that's the case, three cases that he decided are coming up. Fisher is one of them. And they say that, no, this broad second category is really not so broad. That word otherwise means you need to look to that narrow first category. And so they say this really only applies to conduct that aims at evidentiary impairment or affecting the availability of evidence. And so, you know, a riot is a different animal. and doesn't apply. So that's the gist of the dispute. And Trump made a reference to it in the immunity brief just to say, see, look at how they're stretching to make this case against me. They've used this statute in an unnatural way that you, the court, have already, are see through and are about to reverse, basically. And what Smith is saying in the footnote is no, even assuming for the sake of argument that the Supreme Court does overturn, the charges against Trump would still stand because the false elector scheme involved, basically forging documents. So it seems to fall even within 1512 C1. So, or it would certainly within any catch-all for 1512 C1. And that's, we've sort of known that. We've known that would be their position. Honestly, if the court is of a mind to accept to agree with Fisher and overturn 1512 C2, it is more harrowing. It is Jack Smith's response is a little glib. It doesn't really wrestle with what their argument now is. The argument has changed as it's come up through the courts. It's sort of gotten better. It's been polished. And the current argument is you need evidentiary impairment or something that affects evidentiary availability. And it therefore follows that the type of hearing we're talking about has to be an evidentiary hearing. And so they're saying, yes, if a congressional proceeding could be an evidentiary hearing, but this isn't one of those. The joint session doesn't take evidence. It's a ministerial proceeding, which is actually the position, that most of the time the government does take in the D.C. case, that, you were just supposed to open the envelopes and count the votes. That's not an evidentiary proceeding. So, if the court does agree with the plaintiffs in Fisher, there is a real danger that this could knock out those two counts, in my view. It is true that since Fisher doesn't really hinge on that question, they may not answer it one way or the other. Even if they do rule for Fisher, it might not be fatal yet. What we really need to study the language, but it does pose a threat to these counts. I will say the other thing, that even though there's like one judge that has accepted this argument in the D.C. in the district court in D.C., there is no judge that has said congressional proceeding means only congressional proceedings that are evidentiary. And that wasn't even argued before Judge Nichols. So it would be weird to have the Supreme Court to be the first court in the land to ever say that. But who knows? They might. That's where that stands.
All right. Well, Roger, April 16th, right?
Yes.
That's oral argument.
Yeah.
I'm sure that you will be watching and have an update for us next week. So we'll see what happens. We need to go to audience questions now, okay. I think. So, Quinta, I'm going to hand it back to you.
Yes. Thank you. So first is a question from Simon from Montreal, who's asking for a follow-up on a question he'd asked last week about what's been happening in the Smartmatic lawsuit against Fox News. Don't worry, I have an update for you.
Oh, good. I was going to say, Simon, we failed you.
So the Smartmatic website, actually, they have a page where they include updates about their pending litigation, which is very helpful of them. Thank you, Smartmatic. And the top line is that the case is moving forward. Fox had appealed a lower court court's denial of their motion to dismiss. The appeals court also denied Fox's motion. And so we are now moving forward and in the discovery process. And Smartmatic appears to have filed another motion recently complaining that Fox is moving too slowly. So if you haven't heard anything, that is because things are moving behind the scenes at the moment. So there you go, Simon. We have not failed you after all. All right. Next question is from Catherine, who asks, how persuasive might the Supreme Court regard the national security professionals' amicus brief that presidential criminal immunity would throw confusion into the chain of command of the armed forces? I confess I have actually not taken a serious read of the amicus brief, so I don't have a good sense of this. Roger, do you?
I did read that brief, and I still don't have a good sense of it.
We will get back to you, Catherine. See what we just did with Simon? Next week, we will read it, and we will have a response for you on what we think. Although I will say, I do have an amicus brief suggestion for everyone if you want to be highly entertained. There is an attorney named David Boyle in Long Beach, California, who always like files these amicus briefs in various cases. Like I've seen his name before as an amicus. And he filed one before the Supreme Court in the presidential immunity case. And it is just the most wildly entertaining brief that I've read in a long time. I'm not even going to say anything else about it, but just read it. There's a Dune 2 reference at one point. that's all I will say about that.
Next question is from Kevin, who says, on the Advisory Opinions podcast, Sarah Isker suggested that in New York, Stormy Daniels' case would likely turn on the judge's decisions about the law and jury instructions, rather than the jury needing to make tough calls. Do you agree with that? And if so, is Trump shooting himself in the foot by antagonizing the judge? So I confess I have not listened to this podcast and I'm not quite sure what Isker is referring to. Do either of you have thoughts?
Well, I haven't heard the podcast. I mean, a lot of people have, you know, worried about whether this, you know, to turn this falsification of business records into a felony from a misdemeanor, you need to have you need to falsify the record in order to commit or conceal another crime. And so there are three candidate other crimes, and one of those is a federal crime under the Federal Election Campaign Act. And so there is a legal question, does the state statute include committing a federal crime? I don't think, I mean, there's no suspense in finding out what Justice Merchant thinks. He's ruled on that. There is an issue, you know, on appeal. If Trump is convicted, would eventually somebody else? To me, I don't think those are going to be I think the key issues are sort of going to be factual and sort of whether the jury, there's a gut level thing. There's a jury nullification issue. If this doesn't hit them in the heart, you know, it's an old case. It's a little, it has strange quality. So, if they think this smells and, looks like a crime, that'll be okay. If they think it smells and looks like political vendetta, which is what the defense will be saying, I think that's the hurdle to get over.
Yeah, I think actually the big hurdle, I mean, obviously the jury instructions are always important. So I don't want to discount that they are a big deal. But I think, Roger, I agree with you that in this case, you know, one of the biggest threats is that you'll maybe have a hung jury or you'll have, you know, a kind of jury nullification-ish problem. So we'll see. But I think a lot of it might depend. Again, this is why jury selection is so important, because it really just depends on who gets on that jury.
All right. Next question is from Jeff, who asks, what is the likely sentence if Trump is convicted in the hush money trial? I confess I don't have the statute in front of me, but I believe it's on the order of months.
Well,
is that right?
He'll be eligible for probation. This is an E felony if he's convicted of, which is the lowest level felony. He's nonviolent. It's a first offender. So he's eligible for probation. The top sentence on an E felony is 1 1/3 to 4. They have indeterminate sentences over 1 year. So that would mean, but in reality, it would mean he would get out after 1 1/3 because they still have parole and everyone gets paroled. But I mean, there are 34 counts. So technically it's conceivable he could get a consecutive sentence. But it's very, very rare.
Yeah, Roger, just to clarify, you're saying 1 1/3 to 4 years or 1 1/3 to 4 months?
Years.
Yeah, that's what I, okay.
Yeah, 1 1/3 to 4 years. Merchan is a tough judge on white collar crime. So I don't know. We do know, Trump's CFO, Weisselberg, got 5 months with a guilty plea, and he got 5 months again with a new guilty plea. This is going to be far from a guilty plea. This has been kicking and screaming for years.
So the next question is from Jeff, and actually, Seb, you have asked a similar question, so I'm just going to phrase them as one. Can or will Jack Smith try to force Judge Cannon to make a pretrial determination as to the applicability of the Presidential Records Act and the question of whether it should be involved in the jury instructions before trial begins and jeopardy attaches? Roger, over to you.
Well, yes, I think probably he would try to do that at a minimum through a motion in limine sometime before the trial starts, and it would take the form of trying to preclude Trump from making certain arguments, from suggesting that the Presidential Records Act has anything to do with being authorized to possess classified information or national defense information. And he'll try again to pin her down then. I think that's the way to do it. There are ways, you know, if you wait until jeopardy attaches and the jury is sworn, there are these cases where people have brought a mandamus then, and it's very tricky, but you sort of need to be sure that the judge is acting in good faith. And if she doesn't hold a conference until after the case in chief is completed, she will have a chance to enter a directed verdict of acquittal that can't be appealed. So I think that there's enough of a scenario here, enough of a history, enough of odd conduct. I mean, just in the middle, you know, we're months away from trial. There's no realistic trial date set for her to, you know, ask for jury instructions and say, even if you disagree with these, write these up as, you know, how would you do it? I mean, she's pretty serious about this. And if she refuses to give that motion in limine, I think people will get the picture. I think the 11th Circuit might get the picture. I think that's doable. I don't think he can do it right now with her just saying, I'm going to rule the way every judge does at the jury instruction conference.
All right. Next question is from Tony, who asks, in the Florida documents case, does the government have any appellate or other rights under the Speedy Trial Act? For example, Canada's determination that the case is complex, that the jury verdict is more important, public interest in the redacted filing, et cetera.
I just asked a professor sort of that question. I would give his name, but I didn't ask, you know, specifically if it was okay to, so I won't. But he, you know, the question was that I posed was, is there any remedy under the Speedy Trial Act for the government? Because ordinarily the remedy for the defendant is dismissal. And so obviously the government doesn't want dismissal. And so he thought, yes, theoretically a mandamus might be the remedy. But he also thought that, you know, given that they haven't used a day yet of the 70 days and you've got 12 motions pending, and as I described, everything's excludable until the hearing, and then beyond that, if there's post-trial briefing, maybe 30 days after that, and you can, you know, stagger these, and then you have the SEPA stuff. I don't think she's going to have a problem delaying this till after the election. And even just discretionary stuff. Oh, it's a complex case. We've had, you know, over a million documents, blah, blah, blah.
So we have a question from Dennis Dorfman, who wanted to know what will happen if Trump wins re-election to these cases in different jurisdictions. So this is a perennial question. You all love asking this question. It's an excellent question. And I have wonderful news for you. There is, I think, an hour and a half long podcast that you can listen to where our colleagues Ben Wittes and Scott Anderson set this out. It's on the Lawfare podcast. It's built off a presentation that they gave. I believe you can find it on YouTube with the slides, but I highly recommend it. It is very, very informative, and it will give you a much better answer than we can in the limited time that remains. I don't know if either of you have any thoughts you'd like to add on that.
I have a quick nightmare version.
Yeah, please. You know?
He, with respect to the federal cases, he would fire Jack Smith. He would order his new attorney general to dismiss these cases. And if there is no judgment yet, and there won't be, judgment means sentencing. So even if there were a conviction, there would be issues about, you know, Judge Chutkan would resist this, Jack Smith would resist this, but we don't know how that plays out. If you remember the Flynn case, Mike Flynn, he had pled guilty, Barr dismissed it. There was some litigation to the D.C. Circuit. It was inconclusive, and he was pardoned. So that's my nightmare scenario with the federal cases.
Quinta, before we go, I have one more. We don't have any more questions, right, to get through?
We do, but we have time for you to do an update.
Oh, okay.
First.
So one little thing that a listener has kindly reminded me of this on the Burt Jones question of the statute of limitations. Georgia was actually under judicial emergency for several, or actually for many months, because of the COVID pandemic. And so that very likely means that the statute of limitations was told. So it's actually not as a ticking time bomb as I suggested previously. So thank you to listener Robert for pointing that out to me. I appreciate it.
All right. Excellent. And then we have one question from Jay, who asks, this is once again on Judge Cannon. I understand that Jack Smith didn't want to antagonize Judge Cannon by appealing her non-decisions and weird requests. In her recent ruling, she seemed to be critical of the prosecution, and in any case, her actions and inaction clearly favor the defense. What would he even have to lose at this point by appealing?
Well, you want to win the appeal, and otherwise you just delay the case and you look silly and they don't want to do that. I think there's a motion pending there are two motions. There's a motion to compel, which is a monster motion where he wants a lot more information, discovery. And that is very closely linked to another motion called a motion for to dismiss based on selective and vindictive prosecution. The showing goes nowhere near what you need to get discovery for vindictive or selective prosecution, and there is no evidence of selective or vindictive prosecution. I think she is sold on that idea. I think she will go with that. She will grant discovery to explore that. I think that's the vehicle for appeal.
All right. Mark your calendars, folks. we have a question from Mike who asks, regarding Fisher, weren't the riot and the phony electors efforts to squelch evidence by preventing Congress from considering the electors' ballots? So essentially what, you know, wouldn't Trump's, the charges against Trump be able to persist even if the court rules the other way in Fisher?
That has been one of the arguments that the government has used even in Fisher's case. I'd say even in Fisher's case, because, you know, there was no alternate elector scheme. They did want an argument that, well, okay, if it needs to have to do with documents, this sort of does. You were blocking them from counting votes. Yeah, that is one of the government's arguments. And in fact, trying to get the Fisher brief and the immunity brief separate in my mind. In Fisher, they definitely want, even if the ruling goes against them, they don't want it to be the count to be dismissed. They want an opportunity to try to meet whatever the new standard is, because this is an interlocutory appeal. The charge was dismissed. He hasn't been tried yet. And you're exactly right. They would try that route.
So before we wrap up, I want to make sure to mention our GiveButter page, where you can help us by helping us fundraise for our Trump trials coverage, either by just donating or you can bid on various items at auction, including a Post-it note that I drew. Anna, I think we do not yet have your drawings.
I keep promising every week. They're coming, okay? And it's going to be great. Everyone's going to want one.
Exactly. So yes, please do take a look at that. And I also wanted to flag something that I believe Ben had mentioned last week, which is that we are going to be mixing up our schedule during the Manhattan trial. So we will be having short, ideally 20 to 30 minute sort of dispatches that you can tune into in the afternoons, evenings after the trial wraps up. We don't quite know when those will be because it depends when Justice Merchan ends the day. But you'll be able to tune into those on Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, because Justice Merchan takes Wednesday for a different set of responsibilities. And because of that Wednesday, we'll be moving this longer live stream with a sort of a broader lens to all of the various Trump activities to Wednesday. So you'll still be able to find us then. And I believe that all of those will be available on podcast feeds at various points. I do not believe, however, I should say that we will be having those dispatches for the jury selection process. Sorry, Anna. I'm sure you would enjoy
it. I'm going to be calling Tyler every day after court and making him give me his own dispatch, you know,
because I'm just
so interested. Although, and I might just show up for jury selection. Who knows?
There you go.
No, I'm kidding.
We will get those dispatches started once the case actually goes to trial and the jury is selected. So keep an eye out for that. And with that, we will wrap. Thank you all for watching, and we'll see you again next week. The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare Materials supporter through our website, lawfaremedia.org/support. You'll also be able to pose questions to our panel and become part of the conversation by joining our webinar on Riverside. available only to our supporters. This podcast is edited by Jen Paccia, and your audio engineer this episode was Anna Hickey of Lawfare. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.